Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Climate change has catastrophic implications for our world, from droughts and fires to floods and sea level rise. According to an October report released by the United Nations, global warming of greater than 1.5 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels may occur as early as 2030, and this increase in temperature has more dire consequences than previously thought. Furthermore, reducing greenhouse gas emissions seems to be not enough to prevent this rise in temperature, and we will actually need to remove CO2 from the atmosphere, so-called negative emissions. In addition, last Friday, a report published by 13 federal agencies warned that if significant measures were not taken to combat global warming, America's economy, health, and environment would all suffer. Here in California, where wildfires have become an all-too-common occurrence, we've been an early leader in the fight against climate change, as Governor Jerry Brown made news last month by signing an executive order committing California to economy-wide carbon neutrality by the year 2045. Fortunately, natural and engineered methods of capturing emissions and removing carbon from the atmosphere already exist, and some of these approaches could actually reduce our risk of future devastating forest fires and other effects of global warming. But what challenges exist to the adoption of these crucial practices? How do these technologies work? What would it take to scale them up? And could it be done fast enough to impact our warming planet's current trajectory? Well, tonight we have three guests with us to explore these issues. In the studio, I'm joined by Jonna Amador. She's co-founder and managing director of Carbon 180, an organization dedicated to promoting practices and technologies that transform carbon from a liability to an asset. Welcome, Jonna.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also in the studio, we're joined by Daniel Sanchez. He's an engineer, energy system analyst, and assistant cooperative extension specialist in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley, where he runs the Carbon Removal Lab. Welcome, Daniel.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And by phone, we're joined by Dan Riker. He's executive director of the Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance at Stanford University, where he leads the Carbon Capture and Storage Project. He's also the former director of Climate Change and Energy at Google and has served under three presidents. Welcome, Dan Riker.
Good to be with you.
And of course, as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll be opening our phone lines in about 20 minutes, but I'll give you that phone number now. It's 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. So I wanted to start with you, Jonna. Tell us about this UN climate change report that came out in October. It seems like what we understood to be the trajectory that we were on and what the solutions were going to be to either slow this down or somehow keep it from getting worse has changed, or has it?
Yeah, I honestly don't think that the findings from the UN IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Special Report on 1.5 degrees of warming, really told us that many new things, but it did make the case for action even more urgent. So when 197 countries came together and signed the Paris Agreement, they signed an agreement to keep levels of warming below 2 degrees Celsius with best efforts to keep warming below 1.5 degrees. And this goal, this 1.5 degree goal, was really important to protect the world's most vulnerable populations, populations that are in developing countries, are island nations, and are really most susceptible to the effects of climate change. So this report really laid out what it's going to take for us to keep warming below that really critical level and protect those populations. What we found in that report was that the argument for carbon removal technologies or negative emissions, ways of cleaning up carbon from the air and sequestering it in our soils, in our forests, and underground, was even more urgent. And we needed to not only just, you know, do the normal things that we think about, like installing solar and using wind energy and driving electric vehicles, but there was this second half of the equation that is equally important and something that we need to work on to develop.
So what we've talked about so far is not producing more carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases by decreasing emissions, becoming less dependent on fossil fuels, so to speak. And now you're saying that that's still all true, but the concern is that we got to broaden our perspective and take on carbon capture or carbon removal as an additional strategy here. So why is there a renewed or new attention on carbon capture? Is it that global warming is going faster than we thought, or is it that as a world we're not acting fast enough on that other side, decreasing carbon emissions?
I mean, honestly, I don't think we're moving fast enough. And I think the 1.5C report was really demonstrative of the fact that we aren't moving fast enough, and we really only have, you know, 15 to 20 years before we surpass this target. And I like to think of, you know, the two parts of the equation, reducing emissions and carbon removal, as sort of diet and exercise. If you're trying to lose weight, you, you know, need to reduce your calorie consumption, put healthier foods in your body. But at the same time, if you want to lose weight faster and if you want to keep that weight off, you also need to exercise. And that's where the carbon removal piece comes in. So if we want to meet our goal, if we want to keep our goal, and if we want to get there faster, we need to do both things.
Now, it might not seem all that much of a difference, 1.5 degrees versus 2 degrees. But, of course, when you think about it, spread over the world, and it has implications. But to give us a concrete sense of what 0.5 degrees Celsius of difference in the Earth's temperature means, give us a sense in some ways that could be understandable by our audience. What are the different implications if we go over that 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in global temperature?
Yeah, I mean, and I invite any of my colleagues to comment on this as well. I think what we're going to see is just an increase in extreme weather events, an increase in the number of droughts that we have, the number of famines that we have. We'll see, you know, an increase in, an even greater increase in sea level rise, and, you know, potentially even more natural disasters like the forest fires that we were experiencing this past month.
And Daniel Sanchez from UC Berkeley, you want to add something there? And going keeping global temperatures from increasing greater than 1.5 degrees Celsius doesn't mean versus 2 doesn't mean that nothing happens. It just means the extent to which bad things happen is less.
Sure. Absolutely.
If I said that correctly.
No, and this is actually a long-standing part of how we've thought about international climate diplomacy. Back in 1990, when we realized that global warming was a problem and we started to take efforts to address it, we agreed to limit what they call dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system.
What does that mean?
It's a great question. I think we could spend hours debating that. But what this UN process, what the IPCC has brought us over these past 2-3 decades is really an understanding that 2 degrees Celsius is something of a bright red line, that once we cross it, we'll really be getting to unavoidable and unreversible climate impacts. Now, that's not to say that 2 degrees Celsius is risk-free, and that's why we've really seen a movement in recent years towards thinking about 1.5 degrees Celsius. But a little bit more broadly, I think, you know, there are really three responses to climate change. One is reducing the future impacts. One is dealing with the impacts that are already there. That might be building a seawall if your sea levels are rising. It might be, you know, picking up and moving whole communities and dealing with retreat from coastal ecosystems. Or it might just have to do with incurring economic costs or suffering. It's as simple as that. And what I think we're really talking about in the carbon removal space is how we can do more to prevent the impacts, how we can avoid the suffering, avoid the necessary adaptation by enhancing the mitigation that we're already starting to undertake and the innovation that we're starting to unleash.
So, and I want to now go to Dan Riker from Stanford. Dan, what do you make of the fact that the federal government chose to release its report on the Friday of the Thanksgiving holiday weekend?
A dark report on Black Friday. I think part of this was an attempt to not shine the necessary light that needs to be shined on the report. I think it sort of backfired. There was actually a story today in the Washington Post about how much attention it actually did get, and arguably got more attention than it might have otherwise, simply because I think the administration went out of its way to kind of cover it up.
Well, I want to ask you to summarize what the report is saying, and then also ask the question, how did the report even see the light of day?
Well, on the second question, that's a great question, and it actually saw the light of day because it's actually a legal requirement. Every 4 years you have to do a report of this sort. So there's no way that any administration could get out of that obligation. And so this administration did have to go forward. And, you know, essentially it's a report, and it is quite a powerful report coming from 13 very different agencies across the entire federal government. A very large team of people put it together, and essentially, in simple terms, it said that the problem is a difficult one, and it's getting worse. And it talked about some of the economic impacts we would see. So it really was a fairly dire report from our own federal agencies sitting within the Trump administration, who said this is a serious problem. Obviously, the president took issue with the findings of his 13 agencies, but that's happened before in the context of many sorts of studies done by current federal agencies.
So we have the UN saying that global warming is keeping on rolling, and if we don't keep the climate from warming even more so than we had originally thought, the consequences are going to get more dire and come more quickly. The U.S. Government has issued a report that says the same kind of thing, and that it's going to have very critical impacts on people's lives. And then we have California. So to bring it home for a moment, let's talk about how California sits in this, where California sits in this debate, and how the recent executive orders or legislation that has been passed by or signed by Jerry Brown are going to really help shape the conversation moving forward. Who wants to start with that one? Daniel?
Sure, absolutely. So I can point towards things that happened as recently as September. So in September, Jerry Brown both signed a law and signed an executive order. The law was actually mandating that 100% of our clean energy or of our energy comes from clean or low carbon sources by about mid-century. And that's you know, again, and that looks like the kind of mitigation, the reducing emissions that we were talking about before. The energy sector, along with the land sector, makes major contributions to putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and warming the planet. And an energy systems transformation, like the kind that California has already started to go down and is continuing to go down, is a really important part of that. But it doesn't get us all the way there. And this
and
is actually,
Daniel, can I interrupt? Correct me
please
if I'm
do,
wrong.
Yeah.
This is Dan Riker. That's our electricity system in California.
That's right. Forgive me. What Jerry Brown did in his other executive order was to go one step farther and was to talk about actually economy-wide decarbonization. So this isn't just the electricity sector, but all emissions within the state of California. He set a goal. Again, a goal is not law, but he set a goal to have economy-wide carbon neutrality by the year 2045, with efforts to become net negative thereafter. So that's actually a functioning and prosperous economy that removes more CO2 from the air than it emits.
And Dan Riker, what do you make of what Governor Brown has promised or at least pledged? He's leaving office, of course, but he set the stage for what comes next.
Well, again, just like we talked about the federal government a few minutes ago, the direction to get to 100% clean electricity by 2045, that's law. The additional executive order that Governor Brown signed was basically a best efforts that he was encouraging the rest of the California economy, in particular the transportation sector, the industrial sector, and other sectors in the economy, to also take real strong measures to cut carbon emissions. So we have a legal requirement to get to 100% clean electricity in the electricity sector, and then we have some strong efforts that have to be taken by other sectors. The good news is we've come a long distance in the electricity sector in California as we've moved to more renewable energy, as energy efficiency investments have increased. But there's a long distance we can go beyond that. And where we have made less progress is in the transportation sector. and also in the industrial sector. I was surprised years ago to learn that we still have a pretty large manufacturing economy in California, refining oil, making cement, making asphalt, doing a variety of things. And it's roughly a fifth of California's carbon emissions comes from the industrial sector. We've made very little progress there. So the combination of the big progress we need to make in transportation and additional progress we need to make in the industrial sector, we still have a big way to go as we also continue to decarbonize our electricity sector.
And so what are the implications for California's current goals on the rest of the country? How much of an influence can California have on what we see happen in other parts of the country, independent of what may come out of Washington?
Well, I would quickly add there that it is the fifth largest economy in the world. So not only does it set a model and send a signal in the U.S., but it does internationally as well. California is just a very big place economically and in terms of energy use. So that's important. I think setting an electricity standard of 100% clean energy, that's a big. That's a big, heavy lift for an economy this large, so it sends a very powerful signal. It's caused some competition as well. The New York State is also in a race, a very healthy race with California, setting an aggressive standard. Massachusetts, Hawaii, there's a number of states that are going down this road towards very deep cuts in emissions in the electricity sector and also looking economy-wide in those larger states as well.
Jonna?
Yeah, just to add to that, I think California has often been thought of as a laboratory for federal climate and environmental policy, and we've seen this with things like what's called the CAFE standard, so standards that set a minimum requirement for the miles per gallon that different types of cars are required to meet. And so California can really act as a critical testing ground for these policies that both incentivize emissions reductions and carbon removal solutions in order to not only encourage and incentivize other states to, compete with them and to take climate action, but also if we were to get an administration or a Congress that was looking at taking a very proactive and progressive approach to climate policy, that these sort of policies would be ready to go for them or already vetted at this point.
So now that we've sort of set the stage of where we stand in terms of climate change and understand that emissions reduction is still very critical and very important, even though we seem to be lagging behind. Let's turn our focus to the technology that has gotten new attention recently, and that's carbon capture and use. Jonna, again, give us a capsule summary of what carbon capture is about, and then we'll get into some examples.
Yeah, definitely. I think the sort of preferred term to help prevent confusion would be carbon removal or negative emissions. These are solutions that can actually clean up carbon from the air and store it away from the atmosphere in order to prevent any sort of climate impact that would happen from that initial release of fossil fuels. And at Carbon 180, and I think sort of in a lot of the more recent literature, we're thinking about a portfolio of these solutions. So anything that takes carbon from the air and stores it can be a powerful solution to fight climate change. And this can be things that use, the world's oldest technology, photosynthesis, and we grow trees and it stores carbon in biomass, can be farming in more sustainable ways to store carbon in soils, or it can be technologies that we're still developing now that capture carbon from the air and turn it into valuable products or store it underground. So we have this sort of really wide breadth of solutions, which is really exciting because there's huge opportunity in developing the solutions and deploying them in communities and creating, economic benefit from them.
So this is Dan Riker. Let me just jump in if I could.
Yes.
Just so that listeners are clear, because there is a distinction to be drawn here. The longstanding term has been carbon capture, and that's typically thought of capturing carbon emissions from power plants and industrial facilities. You burn coal, you capture the carbon dioxide. You run a steel mill, you capture the carbon dioxide. What Jonna's talking about is a further twist on this, which is direct removal of the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The goal is similar. How do we, you know, keep carbon out of the atmosphere? But we're talking about two different approaches to cutting carbon in the atmosphere. One is you're pulling it out of facilities that might otherwise pump it into the atmosphere. The other is you're pulling it directly out of the atmosphere, either using man-made technologies or using Mother Nature. So this conversation, you know, to give folks the broadest sense, really would need to cover both. And then once you've either removed it directly or captured it from various kinds of facilities, then you need to figure out what to do with it. And that's carbon management, carbon use.
Okay, so storing it versus correct. Using it.
Yeah.
Okay. Daniel Sanchez, do you want to add your spin on this too?
Sure. While we're at it, I think one of the easiest ways to think about these carbon removal solutions that Gianna brought up, as well as some of the more conventional carbon management solutions that Dan Recker mentioned, is to really think about what is doing the capturing. And so when you're growing trees, when you're storing carbon in soils, when you're doing these kind of natural approaches, it's biology that's doing the work. It's photosynthesis. And when you're scrubbing CO2 from the air or scrubbing it from a smokestack or from an industrial facility, it's chemistry. You're running a separations process, something like think of a giant membrane that lets one thing through and not the other. These are fundamentally different kind of processes that capture the carbon, but they give us a pretty easy way to distinguish between the different approaches.
All right. And so we're going to get deeper into those approaches and understand what's keeping us from adopting them and scaling them up. But first, I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we are discussing capturing carbon emissions, removing carbon emissions as an additional tool, a necessary tool, depending on who you speak to, like the UN, in our armamentarium against climate change. And we have three guests joining us to discuss this. Gianna Amador, she's co-founder and managing director of Carbon 180. Dan Recker is executive director of the Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance at Stanford University, where he leads their carbon capture and storage project. And Daniel Sanchez, assistant cooperative extension specialist at UC Berkeley, where he runs their carbon removal lab. Our phone lines are open for you if you have questions or comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, tweet us, or post a comment on our Facebook page. Okay, so let's break this down some more. So we're talking about capturing CO2 emissions at the point of creation, right? So what are those kind of technologies? And tell us kind of how they work. What are their pros? What are their cons? How much they cost? You know, how do you understand this as a solution?
Sure, absolutely. And if we're talking about these more engineered approaches to capturing carbon and storing them, again, it usually takes the form of the chemistry that I mentioned before. It's putting a carbon capture unit. These literally run large solvents through power plants or through industrial facilities. They concentrate that carbon dioxide, and then you have to decide what to do with it. So one option is that we can compress that CO2 into it's called a supercritical fluid. It's neither a gas nor a liquid. It's both. And we sequester it underground. We store it underground in empty pore space that's typically 1,000 to 3,000 meters below the Earth's surface, where we expect it to stay for centuries or millennia, relatively safely. And we have a lot of historical analogs that make us think this is the case. This is what we call carbon capture and sequestration. There also are ways to store carbon in other products. This might be the wood that you build your buildings out of. This might be a product that is long-lived. Think your shoes that don't break down when you throw them into the landfill. This could be something like concrete, which, of course, you know, stays in our built environment for decades or centuries. There are all these ways to transform that carbon into something that is outside of the atmosphere. Some of them cost money, some of them make money. More of them cost money than make money right now.
And so this idea of pumping CO2 into the earth, that sounds pretty, I don't know, for someone like me, sort of science fiction. So where does this concept come from? What are the precedents that you mentioned? And how is this going to keep, you know, how are we going to keep it down there in the first place, or keep it from exploding or something? I can imagine a lot of people wondering, like, what's it like to pump CO2 into the earth?
Sure, absolutely. And I get this question all the time because I think it strains how we generally think about carbon and renewable energy. People think about their electric vehicle. They think about their solar cell on their house. Here we're actually talking about, again, explicitly carbon management. And it turns out that we have a lot of analogs from the existing oil and gas industry. You know, we have been managing geologic reservoirs and pulling fluids out of the ground for, you know, centuries at this point. And what we're really doing is kind of almost running that process in reverse. We know a lot about what the risks looks like. We have, again, natural analogs. We have very detailed modeling studies. We also have examples where we've been doing this for the past 1 to 2 decades that give us a very good sense that it will be secure and that the risks can be monitored and managed. Again, building off of lots of analogs from the oil and gas industry.
Dan Reichert, what's your take on this carbon capture and sequestration?
So I think it has promise. I think we're making progress technologically. I think, as Daniel Sanchez indicated, one of the challenges is how to make it work economically. Let me give you a few quick examples. There's a coal plant in Texas where 90% of the emissions from that plant are now captured and pumped down into an old oil field. There's a similar plant in Saskatchewan in Canada. There's a ethanol production plant in Illinois where they're pumping it thousands of feet underground deep into an aquifer. The ethanol is an interesting place because, you know, if you think about making beer, the stuff that bubbles off the top is pure carbon dioxide. Same thing in a big ethanol plant. So that CO2 that would otherwise have gone up into the atmosphere, instead it's getting pumped down into a very deep aquifer. There's an oil refinery in Texas where they do something similar. There's a natural gas-fired power plant being built in Texas. So we sort of know how to do this. We are doing it on kind of beginnings of commercial scale. As you heard, there's some confidence about being able to put it deep underground and have it stay there. And there's recent tax incentives from the U.S. Congress that make this more attractive economically. But let me quickly add that over the longer haul, we also need to do all we can to find other uses, arguably more economic uses, for the CO2. You know, make it into other things, put it in cement, as you heard, use it to make plastics, use it to make other kinds of materials. So actually create a fairly robust industry that uses this CO2 for other products. We got a long way to go there, but there are a number of venture-backed startups here in California and elsewhere that are working on all of that as we speak.
So if you went to the coal industry, would they use this as an example of how we can clean up coal?
Increasingly, they are. I have to say, there was reluctance about getting too close to this technology in the coal industry because they were fighting a broader battle over EPA regulations and the like. But I think increasingly, as the industry, particularly in the U.S., finds itself in deeper and deeper trouble economically as more and more plants are being closed down, I think it is being seen as a way to keep emissions out of the air from at least those that keep running. And more importantly, you know, the unfortunate fact is we're building more new coal plants around the world. So to the extent that happens, you know, all things being equal, we'd be better off to make sure that we're capturing some or all the CO2 from those plants if we can. we'd be better off not building them in the first place. But if we're going to be building them, if they're going to be operated, let's capture the CO2. Even more importantly, with natural gas fire generation, because there are a number of plants being built there. It is a replacement for coal. And then ultimately, you can also capture CO2 from biomass power plants. And if you put that in the ground, you actually can cause a net negative emissions profile in the atmosphere.
And John, I wanted to ask you, what do you make of this? Is this going to allow us to keep burning coal longer than we ever wanted to and kind of reverse our attempts to move away from coal?
Yeah, I think this is a question we get a lot, and I think it really boils down to incentives. There's an incentive today for energy companies, manufacturing companies, and others in heavy industry to put emissions in the air, and what we need to do is provide an incentive for the opposite. And so I think by creating an undeniable economic case for action, by creating products from captured carbon, by providing a policy incentive to put this carbon underground, we can flip that narrative on its head. So, like I said at the beginning, we definitely need to reduce emissions as much as possible, but we need to also face the reality that we're just not on track. Mm-hmm. And there will be new coal plants that are coming online in the next 20 years. And this is a way that we can prevent that from drastically altering our climate.
I just have this image of the coal futures on the stock market. You know, how are we going to commodify coal in a way that's going to – carbon futures on the stock market. Oops. So you see how confusing it can get right away? But carbon futures on the stock market. So you're basically saying that you're trying to find a way to monetize carbon.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's something we sort of laugh about now, but at the federal level, that's one of the reasons why we're seeing bipartisan policy support for this. So there were a couple of bills that were introduced, one of which was passed this past year, that incentivized the capture, use, and storage of carbon dioxide. And there were 24 co-sponsors for that bill, which came from across the aisle. And that's really powerful. And the fact that we can get climate policy passed in 2018, when that's not a big item on the federal agenda, says a lot. So I think if we're looking to make progress in a bipartisan way in the near term, this is one of the avenues we can do it in.
All right. We're going to take some calls in a couple of minutes, but first I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, 91.7 FM. And I'm Joseph Pache, and we're joined by Jana Amador of Carbon 180, Daniel Sanchez of UC Berkeley's Carbon Removal Lab, and Dan Riker of Stanford University's Carbon and Capture and Storage Project. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or tweet us at KALW. So let's go first to Ed from Menlo Park. Ed, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Joseph, for another very interesting program. My question is, I'm always hearing that the successful expansion of solar and wind energy to displace the fossil energy depends heavily on improvements in energy storage. What are the prospects for such continued improvements in battery technology, or perhaps in, I've heard of wind, I'm sorry, air pressure in caves, sending water up to higher elevations, all these different ideas, but are these going to pan out? Are they going to make wind and solar able to take up the load from these fossil fuels?
All right, thanks so much for your call there, Ed. So Daniel, we'll start with you. Because it was a little hard for me to hear, Ed, do you mind just recapsulating his question?
Of course.
Thank you.
So Ed was talking about energy storage technologies, which are necessary when you're dealing with a variable or an intermittent power source like solar electricity or wind electricity, which of course depends on when the sun shines and when the wind blows. And we've actually seen dramatic improvements in energy storage technologies, including cost reductions, including supportive policy within the state of California. I am quite optimistic about the role that energy storage can play in reducing CO2 emissions. At the same time, though, I actually do think that carbon removal can provide additional flexibility that we can get to deeper and even more stringent emissions reductions, because there are going to be some times when it's a lot easier to run that natural gas plant for an hour than it is to build a remarkably large battery to serve that last hour of load, that last hour of peak demand when the sun isn't shining and when the wind isn't blowing. And if you compensate for the CO2 emissions from that, say, that natural gas plant with a negative emission, you could still have a zero carbon economy.
And Jonna?
Yeah, just to add to that, I think one of the sort of interesting frontiers that we're exploring now is the ability to couple what's called curtailed renewable energy, so energy that's produced in excess that we can't use at that specific time that it's generated, to power carbon removal technologies. And the technology they most often associate this with is called direct air capture. And these are basically giant fans that directly capture carbon from the air and separate it out from sort of the rest of the molecules that are in the air. And so that process requires oftentimes a lot of heat and a lot of electricity. So the extent to which we can use curtailed renewable energy or excess renewable energy to power that technology provides us a really interesting opportunity to both reduce emissions and clean them up.
Yeah, this is Dan. I just wanted to go back to Ed's point, and are you hearing that noise on the line? I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
Okay. I would echo what Ed said. I think that we really do need to make a lot of progress in energy storage, and we do have a long way to go. Batteries are one piece of this, but thermal storage, compressed air storage, mechanical storage, the biggest of all these days is pump storage. That's most of our capacity in the U.S. Thermal storage, we have to make a lot of progress. The good news is that we are making a lot of progress. There's a lot of competition, very healthy competition, and I think if we do make that kind of progress, at the same time we're advancing these carbon capture and storage technologies, we're just going to be in a better position overall to make the kind of emissions reductions we need to. If you think about getting to 100% clean energy in the California electricity system, which is what the law now provides, we're going to need everything, and we're going to need it as quickly as possible.
So I want to go to another question from Jane in Oakland, who asks about the role of the forest in carbon management. And I think this turns us to the other part of this strategy, which looks at the natural ways that we can trap carbon. So tell us about those, Jonna.
Yeah, so I think of natural solutions as an equally important part of this puzzle. So Daniel Sanchez talked a lot about the ways that we can use chemistry to capture carbon from the air. But using photosynthesis and using biology, natural ecosystems for centuries have captured carbon on their own and have stored that carbon safely. So these natural ecosystems like forests, wetlands, and agriculture lands are something that we can harness and use to capture more carbon. And so we know how to do this fairly well on forests. The idea there is to prevent deforestation, prevent cutting down forests as much as possible, and continue to expand and reforest areas of land that were previously cut down. In agriculture lands, this is sort of more of a frontier approach. There are, you know, a number of agricultural practices that are in our toolbox that we can implement now. For example, no-till agriculture, planting cover crops on row crop agriculture, applying compost to rangelands where we graze cattle, and all of
these. What do those do?
All of these solutions store more carbon in the soil, and they basically use photosynthesis to store carbon deep underground in a way that it won't be released back into the atmosphere. And these are really, you know, exciting solutions because it gives us a way to continue to use our lands for economic benefit while, you know, building healthy soils. A soil that has carbon is one that's more productive, one that, you know, can be passed on for generations of farmers, but at the same time can help fight the climate problem.
Yeah, and this is Dan Riker. If you add one more element to this, there are lots of managed forests. For example, in the U.S., the southern pine forest in Georgia and states in that vicinity. If there's a increasing industry there to make wood pellets out of the trees cut in those managed forests, you can replace a proportion of the coal going into a coal-fired power plant with these wood pellets. That will have good impacts on carbon emissions. You can actually create a power plant that runs fully on these wood pellets, and if you put carbon capture on the back end of that, either use the CO2 in a useful product or pump it underground, you will actually end up causing a net negative emission. You'll see a net reduction in global atmospheric concentrations of CO2. So this whole idea of managing this from the natural side, I think, makes a lot of sense, and you can link that then back to the engineered CO2 capture as well.
And when we're talking about cost, how do these two strategies compare?
Yeah, so the natural solutions are sort of ready to be deployed today, much more so than some of the technological solutions, and they can be deployed at much lower costs. For forests, we're seeing significant sequestration possible at a price around $10 per ton, which is very feasible if you think about California's carbon market operating around $13 per ton, where a technology like direct air capture, the big fans that I talked about earlier, we're seeing, you know, cost more around $600 per ton, with the opportunity to get that cost down significantly with technological innovation. But if we're thinking about what can we deploy today and at low cost, natural solutions are the way to go. And then at the same time, we can invest in research and development to bring down the cost of these technological solutions.
So if natural solutions are ready to go and they're much cheaper, why isn't that enough of a solution? What are the limitations?
I mean, simply put, they're just not going to get us to scale. And I think you can sort of think of this in an analogous way to the way that we think about renewable energy. Dan said earlier, we put solar where it's sunny and wind where it's windy. And you need to do the same thing for carbon removal. It's not going to make sense to, get rid of all of our urban areas and plant trees. We need to put forests where it makes sense. And where it doesn't make sense, maybe we put direct air capture. Maybe we put carbon capture and storage. Maybe we farm in more sustainable ways.
Yeah, and I would add that in between that, the $10 a ton that Mother Nature might do it for and the $600 a ton of direct air capture, at least as of today, we have kind of more traditional power plant and industrial carbon capture that you can be doing, you know, for under $100 a ton. And with these tax credits and other sorts of things, it can get into the fairly cost competitive range pretty quickly.
So, Daniel, go ahead.
Oh, sure. Last thing I just wanted to say about these biological solutions is that they do saturate over time. So think about a forest. As a forest grows, the rate of growth of the trees naturally slows over time. They end up storing a lot of carbon, but the ability to continually remove CO2 from the atmosphere unfortunately saturates. And that's where we really need these engineered solutions, this carbon capture, these direct air capture technologies, a number of other technologies we haven't talked about today. This kind of a novel ways that we can use really the tools of engineering and the tools that that power modern economies to remove rather than emit CO2.
All right, so we're going to go to a couple of emails that we got. It seems like my question earlier didn't seem to quiet down concerns about what are the risks of burying carbon dioxide into the earth. Again, what are some of the things that could reassure people that's not going to be a problem? That's an email from Sam, by the way.
Sure. Well, so this is fun, and Dan, feel free to chime in yourself as well. But I would go back and say that I think that there are a mixture of natural analogs, numerical simulations, and actual lived experience of pumping CO2 underground into empty pore space that tells us that we expect that CO2 to stay there for centuries and millennia, or we can monitor it, and through a good monitoring, reporting, and verification program, understand if that CO2 is migrating, see if it is leaking, see if it is moving into local groundwater sources. I think I'm relatively new to being a geologist, but the more time I spend understanding what is underneath the ground and what geology looks like, what different layers of rocks and strata there are, where all the empty pore space is, we actually think that there is a really viable and a relatively low risk opportunity here.
Dan?
Yeah, I would just add that there's actually, for a few decades, we've been pumping CO2 into old oil wells in states like Texas and New Mexico. And there's thousands of miles of CO2 pipelines to move it around. And we produce roughly 5% of U.S. oil as a result of it from fields where CO2 has been pumped in. So we actually have a lot of experience, at least, putting CO2 into old oil wells. We also have increasing amounts of experience putting it deep underground, thousands of feet underground, into salty aquifers that we don't use for fresh water. So I would not call this a kind of a science experiment at this point. There's quite a bit of data that's been collected, and at least the geologists who've been monitoring have been relatively comfortable with how it's worked so far.
So one of the things you said there, Dan, leads us to another email from Ben. You mentioned the CO2 transport. What infrastructure is necessary for carbon capture, transport, and utilization? What is already in place? Can we use this existing infrastructure rather than having to build a new infrastructure?
It's a really important question, and it doesn't get talked about enough. If we pull it out of the atmosphere through direct air capture, if we pull it off the back end of a power plant or an industrial facility, and then we're going to go use it for something, we've obviously got to transport it. That typically requires dedicated CO2 pipelines. You pump the CO2 just like you would through a natural gas pipeline or an oil pipeline, and you have to build specialized piping to do that. As I said a few minutes ago, there's a few thousand miles of that already exists in the U.S., mostly in the Southwest and Texas. So we are going to have to build more of it as we begin to take CO2 from other places in California or in the Northeast or in the industrial Midwest. And the good news there is that there is nothing exotic about the technology, so we know how to build it. It's not cheap, but there are ways to finance it. And so I think it's just going to be part of this whole infrastructure that has to be built to capture it, transport it, and then find a use for the CO2.
And do it in a carbon neutral way?
And do it in a carbon neutral way, and do it in an economically competitive way, and an environmentally responsible way.
Okay, so we're going to take this to the next level. We have someone who's obviously listening and has a very deep understanding of what's possible here. So we're going to go to an email from Stan, who says, what direct removal technologies appear most promising? Refrigeration and condensation, chemical stripping, other? I'm looking around the table here, and Daniel Sanchez wants to take this one.
Sure. Well, so there are all different kinds of ways to do chemical separation of CO2 out of the atmosphere. When we're talking about something that is as dilute as CO2 in the air right around us, we're talking about 400 parts per million, which is the current current concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. So out of a million particles, 400 of them are CO2. It is relatively chemically, it's relatively hard and relatively energy intensive to do so. The vast majority of materials and processes that have been developed for direct air capture do specifically use kind of chemical absorption or adsorption. And what that really means is that's capturing CO2 in on a solid plate, on a solid sorbent, or in a liquid solvent. This is something like ammonia. And there has been relatively less effort at the other ways that we might be able to do it. For example, say we freeze air, we can do cryogenic air capture. We can lower the temperature up to a point where CO2 naturally kind of freezes out of the air. Turns out that's a very low temperature. And we could do other things like build really large giant membranes that selectively let CO2 through instead of the rest of the air. All of those haven't looked as promising as the more traditional kind of chemical methods we've developed so far.
All right. Well, we have about less than 10 minutes in the program left, so I'm going to talk about what's it's going to take to develop these technologies, finance them, implement them, get people to agree to do this. Dan Riker, do you want to kind of give a first stab at that set of questions?
So I think about this as a triangle of technology, policy, and finance. If what we want to do is advance the carbon capture, carbon removal, and utilization area, we've got to continue to develop the technologies, as you just heard. Direct carbon capture from the air is going to require continued improvements in the technology. We've got to definitely develop technologies that are going to allow us to do things with the carbon that we capture, innovative things, economically sensible things. That's going to take a lot of work. Policy can really help. As you heard earlier, the Congress adopted a tax credit to encourage people to put carbon dioxide in the ground or use it for other purposes. It's a rather healthy tax credit. It got adopted by the current Congress. There are other pending incentives as we speak, which would incentivize the carbon capture side of this, not in addition to incentivizing putting it underground or using it for other purposes. And that's pending in the Congress right now. We could adopt that. As we heard earlier, we've really got to work hard on developing a carbon dioxide transport system, you know, essentially pipelines. And then all of this comes back to having adequate capital. We're looking at multiple billions of dollars that it's going to take, whether it's capturing it from an industrial facility or power plant, whether it's building a new factory to turn CO2 into a new material. So the project finance community, the venture capital community, the government's got to help put some money on the table to incentivize these investments. So a lot has to happen at all three points of the triangle, but I'm relatively optimistic that we can make progress at each of those points in the triangle, and if we integrate across all of them, we can really make progress overall in this important area.
And to each of you, how long do you imagine this is going to take? So for Jana, to reforest, how long does that take, and how soon can we get started?
I mean, I think we could get started today. There are countries around the world that already have reforestation goals or sustainable agriculture goals. So that's something that we can get started on now. But if we're thinking on the technology side, it took us, you know, from the 70s until about now to really get solar down to a cost-competitive level. So we're really looking at sort of 30 years of technology development to really get these solutions to be deployed at scale. And I absolutely think, you know, with Dan's triangle, we can move faster and we're going to need to move faster. But, you know, technology development takes a long time and deployment incentives really take a long time to get us to the scale that's meaningful for the climate.
And Daniel, do you agree with that timeline?
I do. I think if you look at, for example, the scenarios that the UN and the IPCC puts out, you know, they show the need and the necessity of large-scale carbon removal, certainly by mid-century and quite likely before, and continued removal and continued scale-up of that industry through the rest of the century. We need to get started today through, you know, research, development, kind of targeted demonstration where we could really, you know, learn how to scale up these engineered carbon removal technologies. And what I spend a lot of my time thinking about is what are the right combinations of technology and policy that get you part of the way there? What's cost effective right now? How can we learn from it? And how can we really scale up new technologies a lot faster than it's typically taken?
And you've talked about incentives. Dan Riker, what other incentives are out there that we can deploy sooner rather than later to really kickstart this development of technologies or the implementation of natural strategies?
Well, let me just go back to where we started at the beginning. I would distinguish here in terms of time frames between what is now fairly mainstream carbon capture technology that you'd put on a power plant or an industrial facility versus direct air capture or carbon removal from the atmosphere. We're pretty well along technologically with carbon capture. We know how to do it. We're doing it. And so it's a matter of scaling up that technology. We do have a long way to go technologically with direct air capture, pulling it directly from the atmosphere. So we need to go down both roads. And As far as additional ways to incentivize all this, one of the important ways that we haven't talked enough about is the role of the federal government in research and development. Every one of the energy technologies where we've really seen great success, whether it's solar or wind or increasingly storage or energy efficiency, the federal government has been there with substantial amounts of R&D dollars, going out to industry, working in the national labs, and we need to continue to do that for both carbon capture and carbon removal and new uses of the CO2 that we capture in through either of those processes. So that's one that I think is very important. I worry some about the current administration, which has tried to cut the budgets for these carbon management technologies each of the last couple of years. The good news is that the bipartisan elements of both the Senate and the House have come back and said, no, we want to see these technologies funded. So that's a very important one. And then there's things that states can do. I think California could become a leader in all of this. So far, it really hasn't, but there are some ideas on the books where the state could kind of take the leadership role that it's shown in other areas, and I'm hoping that that happens sooner rather than later.
And, Jonna, going back to the beginning of the hour, what role do you see the UN playing in moving this forward on a global scale? And I don't know if any of you want to even guess, hazard a guess, as do you see as carbon capture as a way for the United States to kind of move back towards the Paris Climate Accords as a way to kind of get back into the fold, so to speak?
Yeah, and if you don't mind, just before we move on to that, I wanted to touch upon something that Dan said about California policy and the way that California is actually taking action on these solutions now. And California has, you know, one of the highest implicit carbon prices for carbon capture and carbon use through its low carbon fuel standard. Daniel, I'm not sure if you want to talk more about that, but
we have little time left.
Sorry. And in terms of the UN, I think each country has what's called an NDC, a nationally determined contribution, that says what they're going to put forward in order to address climate change and reduce emissions and remove carbon. And so we see countries now starting to incorporate these natural solutions, include some of these technological solutions. So really equipping countries with the tools to incorporate those into their national level commitments will be really important in the next couple of years.
And Daniel, where can people read up more about carbon capture and use and so that they can understand where this technology is headed?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think there's a number of places one can look. I would say that actually the Carbon 180, the organization that Gianna works for, is an excellent source for understanding about carbon removal. There's also a great group called the Carbon Capture Coalition that advocates for federal policy, and I know Dan Reckers worked closely with them. So great places to learn.
All right, well, we'll have to stop it here. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Gianna Amador, co-founder and managing director of Carbon 180, Dan Reicher at Stanford University, where he leads the Carbon Capture and Storage Project, and Daniel Sanchez, who's from UC Berkeley, where he runs their carbon removal lab. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show is produced by Kendra Klang. Please join us next Monday as we talk about how California's congressional delegation is preparing for the Democrats' takeover of the House in January. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.